Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Of the top 12 OECD industrialized nations, the United States comes in dead last in spending on basic energy research. We spend more on dog food research and development than on electrical power R&D. But hopes for market-driven breakthroughs took a big hit this year when Congress refused to put a price on carbon emissions. Now big voices are calling for a Manhattan Project-scale federal investment in game-changing clean energy science. But the pushback says we can't afford it. This hour on Point, the call for the U.S. government to invest big time every year in the science for a clean energy revolution. And the pushback. You can join the conversation. Is it time to invest your tax dollars in the deep science that could produce the next energy revolution or not? And if we don't, who will? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll hear in a few minutes from a top energy economist and from the conservative American Enterprise Institute, which, along with the liberal Brookings Institution, is now calling for maybe $25 billion a year in new federal spending on clean energy research. But first, what happened to the last push for cap and trade and a price on carbon? Joining me from Washington is Ryan Lizza, correspondent for The New Yorker magazine. His recent story, As the World Burns, How the Senate and the White House Missed Their Best Chance to Deal with Climate Change, dissected the failure of cap-and-trade legislation. It's available online. You can link to it by going to our website, onpointradio.org. Ryan Lizza, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Tom.
Remind us, what was cap-and-trade? What was the point?
It's a good question. A lot of people don't really understand it. Cap-and-trade, the simplest way to explain it is you put a cap on the overall amount of carbon that we can emit in this country, and then you allow the individual emitters to sort of regulate their own emissions by trading essentially government permission slips to emit that carbon.
So this would have effectively have put a kind of price on carbon or made a market that would give market incentive to find other ways.
Yeah, and that's really important because right now it's free. I mean, carbon. Yeah, the way to think about carbon now is as a pollutant. It is warming the earth, and everyone from the Supreme Court to the EPA has declared it a pollutant. And right now it's free for any of us to emit it. So unless you get the power companies and the big manufacturers and the oil industry to take responsibility for the emission that they're currently allowed to just spew into the air, there's not much incentive for them to move to alternative fuels.
And when you say carbon, you mean, of course, oil and coal and right on down.
Yeah, that stuff in the ground is these fossil fuels that's trapped right now in the earth, but when it's combusted, is released into the atmosphere where in too high a concentration, it starts warming the earth.
Before we get onto Capitol Hill, Ryan, out around the country, who was for cap and trade and why? Who was against it and why? It failed, we know that, but
yeah.
Who was for it? Who was against it outside Capitol Hill?
Well, the interesting thing about this issue is just a few years ago, you had actually more people for cap and trade than you have right now. The big change on the issue of global warming and cap and trade is in the Republican Party. Remember, John McCain ran in 2008. That it was a weaker cap and trade bill, but he supported a cap and trade bill. But in the time since 2008, the Republican Party has really, really shifted on both the belief in global warming and in adopting any of the solutions like cap and trade to address it. If you look at the public polling, all the shift in this country on the issue is mostly among Republicans.
Let me take it away from politics completely.
Yep.
Leave parties, politics out of it. Away from politics, who's for it and who was for it, who was against it, and why?
Well, anyone that thinks that we are spewing too much carbon into the atmosphere. I shouldn't say anyone, but a lot of people believe this was the sort of compromise proposal, right? There are different ways to deal with all that carbon that's being emitted. You could tax it.
That is, maybe put a price on emissions or a price on tax or oil use.
Yep. A lot of economists would tell you that's the easiest way to do something. You want to reduce something, then just tax it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in this, not to sneak in a political point here, but it's tough to pass a tax. obviously something that would rightfully be called an energy tax. So cap and trade was viewed by a lot of folks as the sort of compromise proposal.
What about investors, I don't know, venture capitalists, others who see big opportunities for clean energy? Did they want it so it would make headroom for their investments?
Absolutely, yeah. If you own wind farms or you sell solar panels, you absolutely want the competing source of energy, fossil fuel-based energy. You want that tax, sure.
And we even had big energy companies who were for it, I remember, back in the day. But
yeah.
But in general, I mean, West Virginia, coal country, did not line up for this.
That's right. No, that's a good point. And a lot of the energy companies are split on this. You have some some energy companies that rely a lot more on hydro and wind and solar, and they often lobby for cap and trade. They lobby for some price on carbon, and you have what a lot of people call the dirty energy companies that are mostly coal-fired power plants, and those guys are dead set against this. So the umbrella group that represents all the energy companies, EEI, or most of the energy, most of the utilities, they have internal divisions themselves.
So take us to Capitol Hill then. Here it was. This was supposed to be the year. You had a kind of bipartisan push here, because you had Democrat John Kerry, you had Republican Lindsey Graham, you had kind of man in the middle Joe Lieberman. What happened?
Well, I think the easiest explanation is that if this was the president started his term with two big domestic goals. One was universal health care, the other was cap and trade. And I think you could argue that the long fight over health care really helped kill cap and trade, because by the time Congress was in a position to take up cap and trade, the White House was not willing to expend the political capital to find, which wasn't an easy thing to do, but to find those 60 votes you need in the U.S. Senate to get cap and trade.
Why was Lindsey Graham a Republican? I mean, bipartisanship is so unusual now, but yet I don't know if it's brave or crazy, but he took the step of saying, I'm in for this. Why did he do that?
And he was the only Republican to do it. And really, on the Republican side, the story of cap and trade is, as 2009 and 2010 wore on, the rise of the Tea Party and the challenges that incumbent Republicans received from more conservative Tea Party candidates really scared a lot of Republicans from even touching this issue. And Lindsey Graham was sort of the only one. And in the spring, the politics got very, very difficult for him. He started being accused of supporting a gas tax and wanting to raise everyone's energy taxes. And this was a point in the process where the White House really needed to kind of handle Lindsey Graham like a delicate flower, and instead Graham felt that they weren't as devoted to the issue as even he was, and he abandoned the talks.
It got rougher out there as he stepped up to originally support this, but why did he do that in the first place? He's no fool. He knows that there was a lot of opposition in his party.
Look, it's a good question. He's not running for re-election for a while. Mm-hmm. Lindsey Graham, I think, if you get to know him, he really is kind of a deal maker, and he was very interested in opening up offshore oil drilling. He was really interested in jump-starting the nuclear power industry in this country, and there was the makings of a grand bargain between Republicans and Democrats on this issue. Republicans get a short-term increase in a bunch of domestic energy resources like oil, natural gas, and nuclear. And remember, nuclear is a zero-carbon source of energy. So a lot of
course, it's all kinds of nuclear waste, but it's not carbon
exactly.
waste.
Exactly. We haven't dealt with the waste problem, but at least it doesn't
right.
use carbon. So a lot of Democrats said, you know what, the global warming is so serious that I'm willing to support more money for the nuclear industry. The Republicans would get that, and the Democrats would get their cap on carbon. That was the makings of the grand bargain, and that's what Lindsey Graham decided to bring that deal to Republicans and see if he could sell them on it, and he failed to do that.
Now Republicans, politicians, very widely deny that humans have anything to do with global warming at all. I'm reading here just today with all but one of the Republicans right now running for Senate deny that.
It's an amazing development, and that's really over the last 2 years. This class that's coming into the Senate is going to be the most anti-climate change class of Republicans, since this issue has gotten any traction.
I mean, even Carly Fiorina, she's in California, she says, I'm not sure. You know, yep. Every scientist says, Sharon Engel, forget it, Nevada, calls it the man-made climate change mantra of the left. But is there talk of anything happening now on the putting a price on carbon front on Capitol Hill, Ryan?
I think the only case, cap and trade is dead. It's deader than it can possibly be. It's not coming back, at least until 2013, at the earliest. I've heard some people say that maybe you could get, as part of another grand bargain on tax reform, if you could do something, get a carbon tax in exchange for a reduction in the payroll tax. There are some economists that are pushing that, but frankly, I don't really see the appetite for that among Republicans.
And what about the idea now, we've just got half a minute here, Ryan, but of putting big federal money, okay, if you can't put a price on carbon, which would encourage then entrepreneurs to go out, they'd have the headroom to go out and invest in alternatives. If that's not going to be the market-driven way that we go, people are saying then we need the federal government to step up in a gigantic way to get us in the game on game-changing clean energy. What about support for that?
Look, as a plan B, that's great, although one of the problems with that is if you did want a cap on carbon or a carbon tax down the road, one way to get it is to buy off some of the people who are against it with that money for renewable energy. And once you spend that money, you won't have it later to get a price on carbon. And if you don't have a price on carbon, you've got a serious headwind if you're trying to really jumpstart all these renewable energies.
Ryan Lizza is with The New Yorker in Washington. His big piece was As the World Burns. Ryan, it's always great to have you. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about whether the federal government should invest big right now and for years in the science of an American clean energy breakthrough, maybe a revolution. With us right now from Washington, Steve Hayward. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, conservative outfit there. Also co-author of the joint AEI and Brookings, liberal Brookings Institution study, published last week called Postpartisan Power, which called for major government investment in research into new energy technology. Steve Hayward, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Nice to join you.
Great to have you. And with me in the studio, Michael Greenstone, professor of environmental economics at MIT. He served as chief economist on the White House Council of Economic Advisors under President Obama and was at the White House during efforts to pass the energy plan, cap and trade. Michael Greenstone, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Steve.
Steve Hayward, first to you, what are you proposing and why?
Well, long story. I should add, by the way, there's a third party involved in all this that deserves mention, and it's the Breakthrough Institute out in California, which is actually the left-wing part of the triad, including Brookings, which think themselves in the center.
Yes.
It's two or three parts that I can summarize very quickly. We underinvest in basic energy innovation compared with other industries in America that spend quite a lot on basic research and innovation. And although that might not be, strictly speaking, a market failure, that's a long and complicated subject, we think that there is room for being seriously concerned about that, not simply for the climate reasons. I remain a climate skeptic about catastrophic global warming, but for the ancillary reasons having to do especially with the oil market, but also looking down the road some decades to not wanting to be behind in the development of new energy technologies when China's going to spend apparently about $750 billion on basic energy research over the next decade. We do think a couple of things. One is our energy research policy should be designed to do something that's not currently part of our existing subsidies and energy schemes, which is the goal of energy research should be to drive down the cost of new energy technologies below those of fossil fuels on an unsubsidized basis. Right now, we just subsidized existing renewable technologies that are more expensive. And so you install them at current prices, which really
limits
how far they can.
Wind and solar.
Wind and solar and also ethanol. And those can't be scaled up very far to replace very much of the The math doesn't work out very well, whether it's for climate reasons or other reasons.
So you're saying kind of a Manhattan's project scale, if not exactly the same style, but scale, I mean, maybe as much as $25 billion a year, federal government money into this kind of research?
We worked very hard for many months on why we came up with sort of that ballpark and number. But I think the analogy to give quickly would be the National Institutes of Health, which pharmaceutical companies will tell you has done over the years some very important basic research on biochemistry and proteins, for example, that then became very important to the development of new drugs. And there's an example of government research that got transferred and scaled up commercially that none of the private pharmaceutical companies who spend a lot anyway would ever have spent on their own because it's too speculative, it's too advanced and theoretical and difficult to do. And so that's why we think that something like a National Institutes of Energy or some other name is a decent model to emulate.
And you're hoping for some big breakthrough or breakthroughs, I don't know, in batteries or fuels from sunlight, solar, smart grid, carbon capture, all that kind of frontier?
Well, if there were plausible answers at scale now, we wouldn't have been having this whole conversation about clean energy for the last 40 years and getting off oil and so forth. I think that my own mind, I'm sort of interested in algae biofuels, for example. There's lots of private money going into that, by the way. And then electricity storage, whether it's better batteries for cars, the current generation really aren't very good, or large-scale storage for energy that's generated that we right now can't store very well for other kinds of uses.
And you're saying this as a conservative.
Sure, but look, I mean, you know, I think we fall too far into the cliches that conservatives or Republicans, whoever you want to slice it up, are anti-science. I mean, let's remember my hero, of course, and I've written two books about him, Ronald Reagan. Portrayed his Strategic Defense Initiative as a scientific matter, right? And then later signed legislation for much expanded funding for the orbital space station. And actually, if you look at budgets before Obama, who's broken all the records, Republican Congresses and Republican presidents have generally funded the National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health quite lavishly. So this really is, I think, a place where the cliche is not correct.
But leave aside science for a minute. Spending is surely, we're going to hear a voice in just a moment from the wing of Tea Party America anyway,
right.
that's very, very, very concerned about spending, doesn't want to see this scale, you know, going into this kind of research.
Right. Well, two points. One is I was insistent as a fiscal conservative that any spending program we proposed be paid for. We were not going to add to the deficit. So we have a range of revenue options. I think you ought to have a dedicated revenue source either. By the way, a couple Republicans have proposed this, like Devin Nunes of California, higher oil and gas royalties on new leases on public lands, or we've even said a $5 a ton carbon tax, which is a revenue measure, not a measure to try and change behavior, change the marketplace. And I can tell you environmentalists are very disappointed that it's not a bigger figure, and I have to tell them it's not meant to change the market. It's meant to raise revenue to pay for something. I'm absolutely against spending money on this if it's not paid for.
Michael Greenstone, you look at the environment, energy, and economics. Does this make sense for a country like the United States, when it's got all the economic problems we've got right now, to spend maybe $25 billion a year? It's still only about a third of the rate that China would be spending, even so, on energy breakthroughs.
Yeah, I think it's important to step back and ask what we're trying to do. I think there's a few points that are worth noting. Number one, fossil fuels like coal are incredibly cheap, especially compared to renewables. That's one. Two, fossil fuels cause climate change, most scientists tell us, and they also constrain our foreign policy options, particularly through importing petroleum. There are two textbook responses to this. The first is having a price on carbon, which is we were just talking about, does not seem available in the near term.
For the moment.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Probably longer. And the key thing to think about there is it's not that we need to reduce carbon emissions in the United States, which we do if we're going to address climate change, but they have to be addressed in the world. And just circling back to the cheap point, our unwillingness to accept cap and trade in the United States reflects the expense of renewables. In poorer countries like India and China, that issue is even bigger. Their income levels are much lower. And what we really need is India and China to find renewables to be a good deal.
So they can't go buy a Prius just because it's sort of fashionable behavior change or even some marginal and important environmental savings. They've got to have something they can afford.
That's right. And I think they're facing trade-offs that are much more severe than we face in the United States. So the only option left then is to invest in basic R&D. just as Steve was suggesting. And a very focused program that was aimed at basic R&D, not aimed at deployment of existing technologies, could play a very crucial role in developing new technologies that would ultimately make countries like the United States, China, and India, and the whole world be interested in accepting renewables.
Breakthrough technologies, not just refining the stuff we've got right now.
That's right.
Okay, there's the case for. I want to hear the pushback from the Watch the Budget side. I believe Matt Kibbe joins us from Washington. He's president and CEO of FreedomWorks, conservative, small government organization. Dick Armey's got a big association with them. Describe themselves as a service center for the Tea Party movement. Matt Kibbe, thank you very much for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We're talking big issues here, energy and this country's future, economic, environmental. We're also talking potentially big spending in a time of big deficits, $25 billion, maybe more a year. What do you say, Matt? Do it or no way?
I say no way, and the budget is one of the issues. We have a massive tax burden on the economy right now. The bigger problem is the deficit, $2 trillion a year, just unprecedented size of debt. These are all problems that we have to deal with first, and that means cutting spending across the board. More fundamentally, I would question the idea that government is very effective at finding the right technologies for green energy. The track record is dismal, and you have all the political incentives that corrupt that decision-making process, and I wonder how you get to a rational outcome when you spend that much money.
What about, you know, we do have a lot of national history in this. I mean, we won World War II with the government investment in nuclear, in that case, nuclear weapons. And, you know, any number right on through, you think that day is over when the government can finance big research and have big outcomes?
Well, economists like to look at opportunity cost. If you do this, you can't do that. And when you're talking about taking resources out of the private economy to invest in a politically chosen, politically favored energy research program, I question the idea that government officials, even the best, would ever have the knowledge to beat the market in that process. And one of the things that really animates the Tea Party is the challenge to government officials to show a little bit of humility about what they can do well and what they should stay out of. And this gets back to the basic core of our founding, that we had limited government because we understood that politics was a very clumsy way to produce things like better energy.
What do you do when the market's not doing it, Matt, as the market is not fixing this problem now?
Well, I think you need to look at what is going on. There's all sorts of
global warming is going on.
Well, but if you're looking for investment in new sources of energy, the first thing you should do is probably level the playing field. I do think there are.
That's what cap and trade was supposed to do with the price on carbon.
Cap and trade moves the process of choosing winners and losers on energy to a very politicized process. You had this awful consortium of big business interests at USCAP, groups like General Electric and Duke Energy, that very much wanted to get a favored position in the trading of carbon. And that was criticized on both the left and right as a way for political savvy operators to get an upper hand in this artificial market for carbon credits.
Matt, stand by. Michael Greenstone, there's the pushback. You know, don't spend the money. It's too much, and it won't work. It's politicized. It's government-related.
Yeah, I think Matt makes two excellent points. And I think everyone could agree if the government were going to flush the money down the toilet or spend it on politically favored projects only, this would not be a good idea. I think, however, there are some really good examples of how the government can get it right. The National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation are both kind of exemplary institutions that have been able to funnel money to basic research, not to deployment.
But they're held apolitical. Energy has not been. Look at the ethanol.
Yeah, super, so I think expensive. If we were to undertake a new program of research and development in energy, we'd want to do it separate from the current mechanisms. Whether that means putting it inside the National Science Foundation, I don't know, but it would have to be done in a different way.
Steve, you want to put it inside the Defense Department.
Yes, the Defense Department has a much better record of deploying new technologies than any other agency. I mean, DARPA is legendary for its role in things like the Internet, but less well-known things like commercial jet aircraft engines, which are three times more energy efficient than they were 30 years ago, and that grew out of Defense Department demands for more efficient and higher performance combat jet engines for fighter planes and such. And, you know, that's the largest, I think the Defense Department has 100,000 procurement people. That's something they know how to do. And so one of our ideas is if the nuclear industry, for example, and by the way, I mean, I'm going to say to a lot of people, a lot of my conservative friends, this report calls for deploying new generations of nuclear power. When have you ever heard environmentalists sign on to something like that? But the point about nuclear power, a government-generated technology, by the way, in the beginning, is that it's been very expensive in its old model, and they demand lots of subsidies for new power plants, which I oppose. But if these small nukes that are talking about, 10 to 50 megawatts, people like Babcock and Wilcox say they can build them cheaply. Well, one way to find that out is to have the Pentagon order up 20 or 30 of them and see if they actually can. We know, of course, and instead are we going to get the $1,000 toilet seat version of nuclear power,
Try it and see. Matt Kibbe, your Freedom Works is out there supporting Tea Party candidates all over the place, the Tea Party movement. If you win a significant position in Congress, do you want your people to vote for or against this push?
Well, I would point out that the Contract from America, which is the essential 10-point manifesto that Tea Party candidates have signed on to, number 8 is passing all of the above energy policy. But understand that the Tea Party is looking to get government less involved, which means less of a burden on capital, less spending, less biases in the tax code and in appropriations that allows for new sources of energy to emerge.
Let's go to our callers. Nashville, Tennessee. Scott. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm wondering why we cannot approach this the way we approached going to the moon in the 60s. We do this because it is difficult, not because it is easy. Maybe now should we do this because it is necessary, it is tantamount to our position in the world, not to mention whether or not our children can make their own children and continue forward, because at our current rate of consumption, we're just going to wreck the whole deal, and frankly, as I look around, that's kind of what it looks like already.
What do you mean it's tantamount to our position in the world, Scott?
Well, we used to be the big guys on the block, and now we are just the big bully on the block. If we could have the technology that changed the deal, whether that be efficient solar or efficient wind, something that's markedly new and important and game-changing, we would then be in a position to tell, say, the oil cartels, to tell their story walking, to tell anybody who basically doesn't want to play with us, and I'm not suggesting for a moment that we need to be the bully still, but if they don't want to play, they can just walk.
Scott, we got it. Matt Kibbe, that kind of comes to you. I mean, Scott's sort of along the line of New York Times columnist Tom Friedman. You know, he said we got to think bigger here, and we're not. There's a budget issue, but Friedman wrote, he said, "Welcome to Tea Party America. Think small and carry a big ego." Is there a risk of that, Matt?
I don't think so. I think it's the opposite. I think Tea Partiers have enough humility to understand what we can and can't do through big government, and understand that markets, when not corrupted by politics, actually work. As the price of fossil fuels goes up, the calculus made to invest in other sources of energy happens. And again, I get back to this question. If we understand all of this and if we see all of these challenges, you still have this fundamental question of whether or not politics is a good way to solve this problem.
But who says, are you above corruption? I mean, you've got Koch brothers money and Scaife money and energy money and behind Freedom Works. You know, there's been a lot of mainstream energy companies who have pushed against getting into alternative fuels because it cuts the value of theirs. I mean, is the Tea Party, is Freedom Works above politics?
Well, first of all, we don't accept Koch money, and that's a long-standing myth in the media, but I think that I don't think that anybody ultimately is above politics, which is why you don't want to centralize power in one place. I think you let the market and competition and the potential of failure hold strong in this process, and we don't like the fact that the government chooses winners and losers.
Matt Kibbe with FreedomWorks, President and CEO there in Washington. Thank you very much for being with us today, Mr. Kibbe.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about whether the federal government should invest big right now and for years in the science of an American clean energy breakthrough, maybe a revolution. Michael Greenstone is with me in the studio. He is now professor of environmental economics at MIT, was at the White House, the Obama White House, during the time they were trying to pass the big energy plan that did not pass there. He's also director of the Brookings Institution's Hamilton Project, public policy outfit there. Steve Hayward joins us from Washington. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He's co-author of the joint AEI-Brookings study published last week called Postpartisan Power, which called for major government investment in research in new energy technologies. You can get a link to that AEI-Brookings study at our website, onpointradio.org. Steve, Michael, we've got a lot of feedback here. First online, Josh Joshua says, budget cutters can go to hell. A major energy project is exactly what we need now. It's what we needed 20 years ago, frankly. Make it so. A little Star Trekian command there. But Nevin says, a Manhattan Project for Energy is just an excuse for Obama to try and ram through another wasteful, failed stimulus package. I trust the private sector to find innovative energy sources. And then there's kind of, I don't know, the voice in the middle. Mark says, I'm with the cynics of a Manhattan-like project. I just don't trust the people who brought us the health care bill, two wars, and all the rest. Unfortunately, I don't see any way, other way of doing this other than with the government getting involved. What about the markets, Michael? I mean, you're the economist here. Why not leave it to the market?
Yeah, so I think this is an excellent point that has come up several times in discussion, that the question is, why won't the market solve this problem? And the answer is quite simple. The market won't do it because there isn't an incentive to do it. Firms can't make money doing it.
Why not? I mean, if you develop a better mousetrap of like some miraculous clean energy, wouldn't the world be the path to your door?
So let's think about it right now. We get most of our energy from burning fossil fuels. When you burn coal, you contribute greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. What does that do? That warms the planet. There is no penalty for doing that. It's as if I could walk over to your yard, Tom, and pour garbage in it, and there would be no penalty for me doing it. If that were cheaper,
Watch out for my dog.
Watch out for your dog. But if that were cheaper than paying someone to come collect it, I would continue to do that every day. And that's what's going on right now with greenhouse gas emissions. There's no incentive for people to stop emitting greenhouse gas emissions. So there's really only two ways to get people to change their behavior. The first is you could put a price on it. You could sick your dog after me, or you could charge me for doing that. And the second is to produce the science that would make the technologies that don't release greenhouse gas emissions cheaper. And that would, and then the world would be the path to your door.
So, Steve Hayward, how do we do this in such a way that it doesn't get, you know, wasted on boondoggles, but really gets focused? Describe the framework that you envision for making this happen. Who, what brain power are you putting to work, and how? Who decides what?
Right, right. Yeah, no, the question I always ask is, how do you get the boon without the doggle?
Yes, please. Yeah.
And, I'm sorry, Matt Kibbe's has left us, because Matt's a pal. And what I'd like to tell him is that early on in the process, the liberals and environmentalists who met around our table here at AEI, I insisted they read Hayek's critique on centralized knowledge and why that's a barrier to effective government research on things. And we wrestled with this problem a lot.
We won World War II. We went to the moon. We've got the internet. Those were all
right.
Government efforts.
I think the Manhattan Project and on the Apollo Project are actually both bad analogies, and we don't use them, by the way. But I don't want to get off in the weeds on why they're bad. Okay. The internet's a little bit different. But I think where the gaps are, even in private sector research, is in some very basic fundamental science questions, basic materials research of how you would make batteries 10 times better than they are today, not just tinkering with existing lithium ion to make them 10% better. They need to be 100, 200, 300% better. And you talk to physicists, they'll say, we need to really get down into the subatomic level of nanotechnology if we're going to make those kinds of breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. There is some work going on about this at places like the Oak Ridge National Lab. But then the other thing is that we didn't put it this way in our paper, but I think there needs to be the equivalent of death panels for government research programs. So that any research pathway or new technology we're trying to tinker with that is not showing progress to being competitive on an unsubsidized basis with fossil fuels ought to have the plug pulled on it. And by the way, we think we should phase out the existing subsidies for wind, solar, and ethanol, especially ethanol, but wind and solar too.
So how would you do that? I mean, if China's out there, you say $750 billion, that's, I don't know, maybe three times what you're suggesting here.
Right.
So we'd better make this investment very carefully and effectively. If we do it, where does the money go? To different universities? To different? How would it work?
Well, we've toyed with a lot of different models, and we're thinking about a lot of those. The Brookings Institution unit under Mark Murrow has especially thought about these sort of technology clusters, of which we see some examples in the past that led to the development of Silicon Valley back in the 70s.
Attributing that to what? To some government foresight there?
There's some. Of this is serendipity, and some of these discoveries happen by accident. So it's very hard to plan this ahead of time.
The HP garage we've all seen, the Hewlett-Packard garage the government didn't build, nevertheless. They were in very early on what turned into Silicon Valley, true.
Right.
But what does that mean? You're just going to look for geography? Surely you're looking for academic scientific expertise here.
Well, I mean, there's a variety of mechanisms you might use. You might even do something like, this is something Congressman Nunes has proposed, a reverse auction process where you actually put out RFPs for, and then you have to have some kind of panel to judge what looks like promising research programs. The point is, it is impossible to tell ahead of time what is the most promising avenues for a lot of energy research. If we knew what the most promising avenues are, we wouldn't be having this conversation. We'd be doing it. It'd be easier. And it's not simply a matter of saying we need to have the willpower to emulate the Apollo project, which, by the way, why don't we go to the moon anymore? It was unsustainable. We sent 12 people there. The energy challenge is the equivalent of sending 1 million people to the moon. That's what people don't understand who use those cliches.
It's so much bigger. It's so much bigger, you mean. But what if Matt's Tea Party gets a lot of seats and sway in Congress, do you think you have any chance for what you're proposing here?
Oh, no, not in the short run, but that has to miss a point.
That misses the point?
Let me finish, Tom. Let me finish, Tom. New ideas or new policy frameworks never catch on overnight. If I do a lot of policy history, things like the 1986 Tax Reform Act, which was a big change, it took several years of percolating along and germinating before it catches on. We think that the energy conversation needs to be changed and changed fundamentally, and we may as well start now that cap and trade has hit the wall. I don't think there's any chance that this is going to get taken up by a prospectively Republican Congress unless we have $4 or $5 gallon gasoline returning sometime in the next couple of years with another eruption in the global oil market. When that happens, that would change the politics of it quite dramatically and rapidly, I think.
Let's go to our caller, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Carl. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for your program. I really enjoy it a lot.
Thanks so much, Carl.
Okay, the question I have there, Tom, is if he spends $12 billion a month in Iraq for years, why can't we come up with $25 billion a year for research? And what profit or what money return did we get in the Iraq thing? What's the profit we are making there?
Ooh, okay, there's a tough one. Mr. Economist, Michael Greenstone, how do you lay those out? It's true, we have spent like $12 billion a month in Iraq. Here we're talking $25 billion a year for what you might describe as the economic future of the country or the environmental future of the planet. How do you weigh these
so
things?
I think I'll try and avoid talking about the returns on the $12 billion a month from Iraq. But
you might avoid the returns, but these are real expenditures. We make choices.
They're real expenditures. And I think one thing that has come out here is we're in a very tight fiscal situation. There's no question about it. And we have to focus our spending on areas where we think that there's going to be high returns. And even in times of I agree with the caller, even in tight fiscal situations, government should always want to take on investments that are going to pay off, that will have a higher return than their cost. And I think that's a situation we have here with basic R&D for energy.
Play that out a little bit. What do you mean? $25 billion a year means it's going to be a pretty good payback.
Yeah, so I don't know the exact level. I don't know if $25 billion is the right number. But what I can tell you is currently we spend about $2 billion a year. That's 1/100 of 1% of GDP. As you said at the outset, we're 12th among OECD countries in terms of energy research as a fraction of GDP. And this is going on at the same time that we're facing a challenge to the planet's well-being, and at the same time that our foreign policy continues to be constrained by our energy security issues.
Steve, I was quoting at the top of the show Arun Majumdar, who's director of the U.S. Department of Energy's Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, ARPA-E, saying that we spend more on dog food R&D in this country than on electrical power R&D. Now, I'm not quite sure how he defines electrical power, but he did say, this was a speech just in my backyard recently, that this top defense research agency has tons of work that needs attention and could use the money. It's not like it'd be poured in and there's nothing to do with it. He says, we're ready.
Well, I mean, to make two points. One about the just a factoid or a footnote to the caller's question about, mm-hmm. It cost the Pentagon, as I understand it, between $400 and $800 a gallon to get a gallon of gas to the troops on the front lines in Afghanistan.
Because of risk and crazy transport and everything else.
Right, the long supply lines and all the rest of that.
$800 a gallon.
Yeah, and that's one reason why it costs us $1 million a year per soldier in Afghanistan, and why the Defense Department, this is the central point, why they are very interested in energy innovation and alternatives to that kind of cost. You know, when the price of oil goes up, it hits the Pentagon budget very hard. What I'd say about ARPA-E and the Department of Energy is that although we give a tip of the hat to Secretary Chu for ramping up ARPA-E under Obama, the Department of Energy is mostly about managing our nuclear stockpiles and not about deploying energy technology. They have no track record and no sort of institutional infrastructure for procurement. And that's why we say the Department of Defense would be a better place to do that kind of thing. So we think that a lot of the ARPA-E work should be transferred over to the Defense Department.
Michael Greenstone, what do you think of it? As you look at it, just as well to put it in the Department of Defense as Department of Energy, does it matter?
I think it's not clear where it should go. I think the Department of Defense is certainly a creative idea. It may be best if it stays as an independent agency like putting inside the National Science Foundation. I mean, one thing that I do want to underscore about ARPA-E, it is in many respects, I think it looks like what both Steve and I think energy research should look at, which is very basic research. But where its big failing is the amount of money that's being spent. It's $200 million per year.
Is the Department of Energy, ARPA-E.
Yeah, and it's literally just dipping its toe into spending and investing in our future.
And what about the payoff? What are the odds here that we can actually find this game-changing technology?
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with knowledge. Knowledge proceeds in fits and starts. You can't draw a direct diagram. If you could, we wouldn't. Everything would be much easier. But I think a big part of a clean energy R&D program would have to include some patience about as knowledge kind of proceeds in these fits and starts.
Al in Charlestown, New Hampshire. Al, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Yeah. In Yellowstone and in Iceland, the heat from the Earth's core reaches the surface, and in Iceland, they use it for their energy needs. Now, the U.S. Geological Survey has on their website a study that says in, I believe, the 50 states of the United States, we could reach the heat from the core of the Earth to boil water to create steam to turn a turbine. Now, nuclear power plants use nuclear fuel to boil water to create steam to turn turbines. So the technology already exists. We've got an unlimited supply of energy. And so even though we talk about conservation being the biggest oil field on the planet, we may not even need that if we were to tap that energy source. Again, on their website, there is a study about
that. Yeah, Al, we've got it. Steve, is it possible that we're that close? You know, design a bigger, more efficient shaft to sink down to the center of the Earth, and that heat's going to send us on our way?
Yeah, this is something that I've been intrigued with and have done a lot of study with and talked to companies who've been involved in some of the pilot projects, like the one in Basel, Switzerland, a couple years ago that had to be stopped when it caused an earthquake. What the drillers tell me is the people who do this very advanced drilling for oil and gas is the idea doesn't work out too well in practice because of the very high temperatures and pressures of the deep drilling you do in certain areas. I mean, we're obviously not going to, Yellowstone and Iceland, the geothermal formations are closer to the surface and easier to get at, but we're not obviously going to put power plants in Yellowstone. And then also those areas where it is closer and easier to get at tend to be more seismically sensitive. And the costs turn out to be very high. And then finally, even when you do it, remember this, that can generate electricity, good. That does nothing to solve our liquid fuels problem or the oil problem.
Transport
problem until we have, as I say, much better batteries to put that electricity into.
So what looks promising to you? What fields? What frontiers?
Well, the one that I've been, the most intrigued with is algae biofuels, which we're, a long way off yet from having, but which have attracted at least $1 billion in private capital. There's one case of where someone thinks if you could make, biodiesel for $2 a gallon, You don't need subsidies, and if you can scale it up, then you've really got a game going. And by the way, the person who does that is going to make billions.
Now, you said earlier, Steve, that, you know, it takes a while for these ideas to catch on. If we get a Republican Congress, you know, give it time. But it seems like the idea that's catching on is budget cutting.
Right.
I mean, you're saying we need this, but the political winds at the moment say this may be a long time off.
Well, that's quite right, but that's, you know, you start changing the conversation as soon as you can.
Michael Greenstone, what about the time horizon for this? Is there a point at which China's put in at $750 billion, the decade is ticking by, and we're just out of it?
Yeah, I think one issue that we haven't touched upon enough here is that the last 30 years have been hard years for a lot of people in the American economy. You know, real earnings for high school graduates have dropped by 12%. Real earnings for high school dropouts have declined by 16%. And I think there's a sense that that stems from a lack of investment in our future. And it even in times of tight budgets, there's always room for smart investments. And I think this is an area where there's real opportunity to invest in our country's future. And the Tea Party and the left and everyone should be interested in investing in our future. And this is a unique opportunity.
An economic game changer, then, you're saying, not just environmental.
That's correct.
And one that would pay off, not just in jobs in China, but in this country?
Yeah, so there's very interesting research that shows where innovation occurs, the ideas kind of stick. And so at MIT, there's all these startups located near MIT, and that's because the ideas were developed at MIT, and that can create jobs here in the United States.
Steve, you're optimistic, just to put it out there. You've got a snowball's chance of making this happen in the USA?
Well, not in the next year or so, but you never know about long-term trends. Sometimes ideas that sit around on a shelf suddenly look attractive when circumstances change.
We'll be watching who's for it and who's against it. Steve Hayward with the American Enterprise Institute, thank you very much for joining us today.
Good to be here.
And Michael Greenstone, professor of environmental economics at MIT. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.